It's Thursday, March 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, controversy swirls around President Trump's new attorney general.
There cannot be even the scintilla of doubt about the impartiality and fairness of the attorney general, the top law enforcement official of the land.
Also ahead, Uganda strains to care for South Sudanese refugees. A Syrian Kurdish woman advocates for refugee relief. The UN says more women are dying from drug overdoses, and there's a new weapon in the fight against lung cancer. That's all on today's International Edition. Thank you for being with us. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Democratic leaders in Congress are calling for President Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions to resign after revelations that he spoke with Russia's ambassador to the United States during last year's political campaign. Sessions, an early supporter of President Trump's candidacy and a policy advisor to the Republican, did not disclose those discussions during his confirmation hearings. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota asked what Sessions would do if anyone affiliated with the campaign had been in contact with officials of the Russian government.
If there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
On Thursday, Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer of New York said that Sessions must recuse himself from any investigation into possible Russian tampering with last year's vote. Schumer said it would be best if Sessions resigned.
Because the Department of Justice should be above reproach for the good of the country, Attorney General Sessions should resign. But whatever one's views are on resignation, the most important thing we must do is ensure the integrity of the investigation.
Meanwhile, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a California Democrat, said that the Trump administration cannot be trusted to investigate itself, and a special prosecutor should be appointed.
The administration clearly cannot be trusted to investigate itself. There must be an independent, bipartisan, outside commission to investigate the Trump political, personal, and financial connection to the Russians.
In an interview with NBC News, Attorney General Sessions said that he has said whenever it is appropriate that he would recuse himself. There is no doubt about that. A White House spokeswoman earlier called the disclosure of the talks with the ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, the latest attack against the Trump administration by partisan Democrats. She added that Sessions met with the ambassador in an official capacity as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Time now for a look at what's making news this hour. Egypt's top appeals court on Thursday acquitted former President Hosni Mubarak of involvement in the killing of protesters during the Arab Spring. Mubarak had been sentenced to life in 2012, but an appeals court ordered a retrial, which dismissed the charges 2 years later. Thursday's ruling is final. German Chancellor Angela Merkel met with Egypt's president during a visit to Cairo to discuss ways of slowing migration to Europe. The Gambia's president, Adama Barrow, on Thursday arrived in Senegal, which played a key role in his rise to power by helping force his predecessor, Yahya Jammeh, from office. Russia says that Syrian troops backed by Russian jets completed the recapture of the historic city of Palmyra from the Islamic State. And U.S. President Donald Trump visits a naval shipyard where the newest U.S. aircraft carrier is being built. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the voanews.com website and on our mobile app. This is International Edition. With famine devastating parts of South Sudan, aid agencies say an ongoing influx of South Sudanese refugees into Uganda is straining their food resources. As Jill Craig reports from Nairobi, a lack of funding and international support is making the situation worse.
Uganda has taken about half of the more than 1.5 million South Sudanese people who have fled into neighboring countries, as South Sudan has become Africa's largest refugee crisis, resulting from more than 3 years of civil war. As the refugees flee conflict, sexual violence, looting, and food insecurity, highlighted by the recent announcement of famine in two counties of Unity State, they're finding that aid agencies are struggling to provide them with enough food in the Ugandan refugee settlements. Charlie Yaxley is the spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency in Uganda. Yaxley says resource constraints meant that last year, food rations had to be cut in half for all refugees who arrived in Uganda prior to mid-2015, with exceptions made for those who were considered vulnerable.
Well, we continue to operate in a context of chronic, severe underfunding. Last year, the humanitarian appeal for South Sudanese refugees in Uganda was $251 million, and we received just 40% of that money. And that has a real direct impact on humanitarian organizations' abilities to deliver critical life-saving aid.
With thousands of South Sudanese refugees continuing to arrive in Uganda every day, including more than 120,000 new arrivals in the first 2 months of this year, aid agencies are struggling to keep up. Chalice McDonough is a spokeswoman for the UN World Food Program in East Africa.
The resourcing situation is so bad that it is possible that we will have to extend those cuts. We have been on the brink of having to do that several times in the last month and have managed to avoid it. But we just are simply not getting the resources that we need to keep pace with the incredibly large number of new refugees that have arrived in the country in the last 6 months.
It costs the UN about $13 million per month to feed the more than 700,000 primarily South Sudanese refugees now living in Uganda who depend on food assistance, a figure which McDonough says is not being met. Approximately 200,000 of the refugees are receiving reduced rations. But despite the resource challenges, Yaxley says that Uganda has an incredibly progressive approach to asylum. It provides refugees with plots of land to build new homes and grow crops, and they live next to the Ugandan host community. They can find work, start a business, and are free to move around the country. He says the host community has welcomed refugees with open arms, but that others need to do more.
It's key to stress that this is not a crisis Uganda and neighboring countries can tackle alone. It's vital that the international community come together with their resources and expertise to, first of all, ensure that humanitarian appeals are fully funded, but also to address the reasons why people are fleeing in the first place.
And because refugee crises are impacting so many places around the world, including Syria and Afghanistan, resources are already stretched thin, says McDonough.
We try very hard not to prioritize one hungry person over another because of where they live. But the problem is that the needs globally are so enormous that there just aren't right now the resources within the international community to meet those needs.
The government of Uganda and UNHCR, the UN's refugee agency, work with humanitarian organizations to coordinate the refugee response at the border entry points, providing clean water and medical screenings that include examining children for malnutrition and providing high-energy biscuits for people who are likely malnourished. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
77 migrants and refugees fleeing Libya were rescued by members of the Spanish NGO Proactiva Open Arms early Thursday. The migrants were sailing in precarious conditions on board a wooden vessel. The rescues were made about 24 kilometers from the coast of Libya as part of an ongoing search and rescue operation in the Mediterranean Sea. Those rescued were transferred to the Proactiva vessel Golfo Azzurro and are being taken to Italy. As the world awaits President Donald Trump's revised executive order on immigration, the future of the U.S. refugee program remains in limbo. VOA recently spoke with a Kurdish Syrian-born refugee whose personal and tragic experience has led her to advocate for open-door policies for refugees worldwide. Elizabeth Chernoff has her story.
The image of 3-year-old Alan Kurdi's body on the shores of a Turkish beach brought the tragic cost of Syria's refugee crisis to the world's attention. Alan's aunt, Tima Kurdi, who was born and raised in Syria, says her family's tragedy also served as a call to action.
A few months later, everyone went to business and forget about the suffering of those people. Mm-hmm. A year and a half later, I keep speaking up on behalf of my people.
Now a Canadian citizen, Kurdi says she feels obligated to advocate for refugees and families like hers who often risk their lives for a chance at a better future.
There is no country should close their border on their face. Those refugees, they are fleeing from ISIS, from terrorists. They're not a terrorist. They are family with children, and they have nowhere to go. They've been forced to flee this country of war, not by choice. And the choice no one should ever experience.
Kurdi found a common ally in U.S. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, a vocal critic of regime change in Syria, who has proposed legislation that would ban U.S. funding of rebel groups overseas. This week, at the Congresswoman's invitation, Kurdi traveled to Washington, where she watched President Trump's first-ever joint address to Congress. With the president's revised executive order on immigration expected in the coming days, the future of the U.S. refugee program remains uncertain. Tima says the president's speech left her cautiously optimistic for the future.
We need to find a political solution to end this. We need to find it. And I'm hoping from President Trump to stop supporting regime change and find a political solution to end the suffering of this people.
Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on International Edition, the UN says more women are dying worldwide from drug overdoses, and a new nasal test can help detect lung cancer early. You're listening to VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
I'm David Byrd in Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. A new report finds a significant rise in the number of women dying from drug overdoses globally, while fewer women than men receive treatment for their addiction and are more severely punished for taking drugs. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva on the annual report of the International Narcotics Control Board.
The report finds governments do not pay enough attention to the huge and growing problem of drug abuse among women. The International Narcotics Control Board, which monitors implementation of UN international drug control treaties, says women get short shrift when it comes to the enactment of gender-sensitive policies. INCB President Werner Sipp tells VOA one-third of global drug users are women, but only one-fifth receive treatment. He says there tends to be a gender bias against women, as they often are punished more harshly for drug-related offenses than men.
We know that women are significantly more likely than men to be prescribed narcotics and anti-anxiety medications. Or we see that women are increasingly being arrested for drug-related crimes in some regions much more than men. They have even a disproportionate increase in drug overdoses.
The report notes HIV infections and mental health disorders are more prevalent among women who abuse drugs. It warns locking women up for drug crimes has a serious and detrimental impact on them and on their children and families. SIP says drug abuse is a problem in both rich and poor countries, though data in African and Asian countries is scant. The report calls for alternative measures to punishment and conviction for minor drug crimes among women. It recommends more investment in treatment and rehabilitation programs, education, and social integration. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, lung cancer is the most deadly form of cancer here in the United States, with nearly 156,000 people expected to die from the disease this year. However, as VOA's Jessica Berman tells us, researchers are developing a test involving a nasal swab that could help doctors determine whether to order further testing in patients suspected of having lung cancer.
Lung cancer is the most deadly of cancers, according to experts, who say that by the time it's diagnosed, it's usually spread and little can be done to save the patient's life. So it's become routine medical practice, especially in the West, to use a high-tech X-ray called a CT scan to see whether current and former smokers are developing lung cancer. But the scans often show lung nodules or growths that will never become cancerous. In many cases, doctors cannot be certain, so they order more invasive, potentially dangerous lung biopsies of the nodules. But there may soon be a non-invasive test that could better inform physicians about how to proceed, either to order a biopsy or do watchful waiting with repeat scans. All it would take is a swab from the patient's nose. The tissue lining the nasal passage of people with lung cancer may show cellular genetic changes, according to Doctor of Respiratory Medicine Avram Spira of Boston University Medical Center. He explains there's what's known as a field of cancerization in smokers and former smokers that can help doctors determine whether growths in the lung might be cancer.
Even though when you're exposed to tobacco, the cancer usually grows deep in your lung, the reality is all of the cells that line your respiratory tract, your nose, your mouth, your windpipe, all those cells are being bathed literally in all the toxins that are being inhaled.
He says cells in the nose can contain the same genetic changes found in malignant lung tumors. Spira and colleagues have identified alterations in 30 genes that taken together form a biomarker that are highly suggestive of lung cancer. In a study of 130 patients in North America and Europe, researchers identified 90% of lung cancers in smokers and former smokers who turned out to have cancer. Spira says the results do not mean that some of those who tested negative do not have a developing lung cancer, but he says the test can offer reassurances to patients and doctors, who can then order repeat lung scans and wait to see whether the nodules are early malignancies.
Physicians want to be able to rule out lung cancer. They're looking to know who can they avoid sending for an unnecessary surgical lung biopsy. And so a negative test here would help do that.
Investigators plan to conduct a larger clinical study and hope to have the nasal swab test for lung cancer on the market in the next 2 to 3 years. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
An earthquake with a preliminary magnitude of 5.5 hit a town in southeastern Turkey on Thursday, causing several injuries. The government-run Disaster and Emergency Management Presidency said the earthquake was centered in the town of Samat. It was followed by 4 more tremors, the strongest of which was 4.4 on the Richter scale. The mayor of Samat told private NTV television that at least 5 people were injured in the quake, which knocked down some buildings in the town. There was no immediate report of any fatalities. The town's mayor said the quake caused widespread panic. The U.S. Geological Survey put the magnitude at 5.6 and said the quake was very shallow at about 10 kilometers deep. Meanwhile, Snapchat co-founders Evan Spiegel and Robert Murphy rang the opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange on Thursday. The company behind the popular messaging app Snapchat started trading after a better-than-expected stock offering. Snap's IPO was one of the most anticipated for a technology company since Twitter's stock market debut in 2013. The stock's opening price was set between $21 and $23 a share, trading under the ticker symbol Snap. Spiegel and Murphy will retain controlling powers over all matters at Snap. The Class A stock being sold in the IPO has no voting power. And Yahoo says it will not pay CEO Marissa Mayer her 2016 bonus, which is worth as much as $2 million, because of a massive security breach her company suffered in 2014. An internal investigation disclosed Wednesday that Yahoo executives failed to act sufficiently after finding information, account information, that is, of at least 500 million users might have been stolen in 2014 and after a separate hack in 2013 that affected 1 billion accounts. Data thefts had threatened to derail the sale of Yahoo's internet business to telecommunications giant Verizon. Instead, Verizon cut several million dollars off of its offering price. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us on the web at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at @VOA_IE. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and to our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Thank you for listening. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States designated Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism in 1984. It also designated several foreign terrorist organizations, including Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad, which receive substantial support from the Iranian regime. The U.S. continues to counter Iran's support for terrorism, destabilizing regional activities, human rights abuses, and ballistic missile program, including, when appropriate, through sanctions and by working with allies and partners in responding to these activities. At the recent Munich Security Conference, the Iranian government's role in supporting terrorism and destabilizing the region was denounced by several participants, including the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia and Turkey, as well as the United States. Given the multiple, interrelated conflicts in the Middle East today, Iran's continued actions and strident rhetoric undermine regional stability and threaten multiple countries, including close allies of the United States. At the conference, Vice President Mike Pence gave clear assurance where the U.S. stands on a nuclear challenge from Iran.
Under President Trump, the United States will remain fully committed to ensuring that Iran never obtains a nuclear weapon capable of threatening our countries, our allies in the region, especially Israel.
In early February, the White House put Iran on notice that its malign activities in the Middle East would not go unanswered. In a move separate from U.S. commitments under the JCPOA, which was solely focused on Iran's nuclear program and continues to be implemented by all parties, the Treasury Department sanctioned 25 individuals and entities involved in Iran's ballistic missile development and sponsorship of terrorism. As a result of these designations, all property subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, meaning any assets of these individuals and entities that come into possession of a U.S. person are blocked, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with these designated individuals and entities. The United States is committed to holding Iran accountable for its malign activities. It is wise to make certain that Iran recognizes that what it is doing is getting the attention of a lot of people, said Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. And we have the responsibility, along with the rest of the nations that want to maintain stability, to be absolutely clear with Iran in this regard. It does no good to ignore it. It does no good to dismiss it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.